SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Enough! Horse racing, handicapping,
interviews.
This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Thursday, race fans, Sirius 162 and XM 207 and Sports Zone 999 and at our website, stevebick.com. We, tell you, we dodged all the alleged weather. It is every indication. Every indication says it's going to be perfect the rest of the way through the weekend. And one of the strange things about the weather app, I don't care what the weather is in Cupertino. The idea that the default Cupertino, I don't care. I'm sure it's gorgeous. How about the local weather, Cupertino? I've never looked on a map. Is there really a Cupertino, or is that like a made up town that Apple created? I don't know. It's going to be absolutely glorious right through the weekend. 80s, clear, perfect. Hope that doesn't spoil our, next week, because Whitney week, always special, and the sale, and, as mentioned with Dick Powell, I mean, August is on the doorstep. You can see it from here, the summer, the August place to be. And yesterday, I've got an agenda today, but not it's hard and fast. It's not carved in stone. the card yesterday. We'll start with that. Thought to myself yesterday by the end of the day, I said, after a very nice, consistent start, that wasn't Sunday and yesterday. There were also a couple of horses that turned up that were funny uncle in the middle of the card in a spot where in the fifth race where you really, it was going to be a problem. Horse, and it's not like he was a big crazy price. He was 6-1, paid $1,360. But you just didn't know, on paper, when you handicapped that race, you wondered if Maker had entered, thinking that the race was going to come off, but if we left it on, and he was out of an Animal Kingdom mare, but the one turf start, and it was early in the career. But that's a horse that, prefer others more, as they say. So you had the entry, and in fact, in the early betting, the entry was a little dead on the board, took a little money later, and ended up going off a little over 3-1. And I don't know, as I saw Funny Uncle and Frank picked him up, in fairly deep stretch. I wasn't, let's be honest, if we weren't winning anyway with Union Express was going to, the Toscano horse was for Brand Jam was going to upset the apple cart too at 22-1. Anyway, I don't mind getting knocked out of sequences. That'll happen, but the most frustrating are those linchpin races that are overlap, you know, that it I mean, you needed, you know, this was a race, started the late pick five, ended the early pick five, was part of that middle pick four. I mean, it was a race you had to be right about. Actually, that's a topic we haven't talked about in ages, which is not necessarily starting your handicapping, you know, with the first race and working well the way through. We used to talk about that more often. Yeah, there's people that handicap from the last race backwards. Then in this, you know, in this particular case, and I can tell you that there's many occasions when, you know, I'll see a race like the fifth and start there because you realize how important it's going to be. So that was a dagger, at least for me. I and, you know, 6-1, people obviously bet Funny Uncle. He's not the only, you know, there's plenty of people who worked him into their play, undoubtedly, you know, so. Because let's see, he was one, two, fourth choice. Fourth choice or third choice? Third choice. Third choice. And you know, by the way, speaking of races that were confounding, in waiting for the turf decisions yesterday, I mentioned that I had left the third race open, and I was going to have to come back to it. And that was a race that, you know, there's times when you do your pass through and you go your first pass, and you jot down some, you know, top of the page, you jot down a couple of win candidates and horses you think figure. And you know, then there's races where, you know, you put a question mark. And I thought that was a absolute proverbial skull buster, and again, this was a $13 winner. Echo and Eternity was not, you know, was not impossible by any stretch, but Malu and Chasing Daylight, and I thought that at the last minute, I used that Shahana, who went off at a big price, the DePaz, from the rail, and ran well for as long as she did. But I thought, you know, I thought she could be an underneath type. Mel's Baby Sister, who chased. But it was Echo in Eternity with Javier for Bruce Levine, who's having a terrific meet. That's what? Is that win number four for Bruce? It's at least three. Yeah, I think that's three. Three for eight. He was, yeah. You print one of the risks of printing these PPs early when they, you know, before their final is, you know, those stats are not necessarily up to date. That's the one little hiccup, you know, at least for my purposes. The PPs are fine. Those two races were really tricky, and even in the eighth, for instance, there's another one. I used Bourbon Day, who was logical, and I tried to get a price involved, High Tide. Paros was fine. Went off at 7-2, second choice, but he was just one of several that could win. So it was that kind of day. Then in the nightcap, that Tongue Twister was certainly, you know, I think I picked her third. This was a Get Stormy for Zilla and Ray Handel with Dylan Davis, who's just Dylan Davis is in the zone. Another two wins for DD. And while we're on the Davis topic, you can't, you know, Saratoga, you can't go two races without running into a Davis. Katie Bug won the opener. And of course, you had the scratch of Macaw that was, you know, was going to be a heavy favorite. I liked Two Tons of Fun going in. Actually, this is our guy Al Gold, and I texted Al congratulations, And he said, well, said 20,000 maiden, you know, we'll take it. Obviously, you know, Al is involved at a high level. But run them where they can win, right? That's and this was a dropper from Maiden Special Company. And actually had, it's funny, he was claimed. And the claim got voided, was a vet void. So they get to hold on to this one. And this was a $100,000 purchase, and had made 10,000 coming in, gets 20,000 for this, 22,000. It would have gotten 20,000 for the claim. So you defray expenses, but instead you get him, and you can probably look for him in a, he'll have to pass the vet again. Winner, non-winners of two lifetime. The maiden race that we talked about, and particularly with Mel Giddings, that second race, the State Preds, that was a fun race, and it ended up being the horse with experience out on bail from the 10 hole, took over, you know, was prominent early, I read, didn't mess around, and gained early position, then took over, and was pretty much, you know, in hand, coming to the wire at 3-2, paid 490. Mel's namesake for Blue, Leon Blue, ran very well and came running. I mean, was last early and was rolling late. And you're not going to see 11-1 when Leon Blue runs back. I'm gonna go out on a limb and say Blue would have bet this one right. He would have bet to win, and he probably would have backed it up with a big exacta. So that was the maiden race we talked about extensively yesterday. I tried that Army Proud, who ran okay at 11-1, and Pay the Juice, the horse of coaches, of Parcells and Shugs, was okay too. Ran a good third in here. So this looks like a productive New York bred bunch. I didn't check the fig. What was the time? 1:02.4 turf sprinting. So anyway, Jimmy Ryerson with that win in the fourth. This was another scratch scenario. Big Ego came out and kind of shifted the money around. I like to Jay's way. This is a Saconette colt. Racing Bread and Ochre House Stable. Andrew Lakeman ran second in here. Good job for Andrew. And those two horses were well clear. Two, Jay's Way and Jansen. They were 1-2 by a half a dozen. Two, Jay's Way. 1260. That was sort of the best idea of the day. We'll take it. In the stake, we should talk about for a minute about Safi Joseph and Miller Racing. How about the Bahamian Squall, Jacks Are Better Bred, Spirit Wind? Mike Smith comes to town. Smith shows up. That should have been a clue that he flies around to ride this horse for Safi. They had him ride at Lone Star in that Memorial Day sprint, and she's been, you know, she's been very solid. The Hurricane Birdie, the Derby City Distaff, those waters were just a touch deep for her. Vava and Alvastar, the ill-fated Alvastar, and comes back now with a graded stake win. You know, she had been graded stake placed. Actually, I take that back. She was great. She won a graded stake. She won the Sugar Swirl Christmas week. That was in between. That was stuck in between. Ralph Nix, of course, brought this one along and did a great job. And, you know, she's a mare now, and she's run four good races this year against all kinds of sprint company. So Spirit Wind 5-1, and you know, Smith gained control early and did not relinquish it. That was it. And they, a couple, you know, clearly unhinged, ran at her. Money's Gold was chasing. A Seed came late, but no, she turned everybody back. And in fact, let me while we're discussing it, let's take a look. Let's go to the figs. Let's see what see. I assume they're done. Let's go to the stakes page. And I don't know how or why I became the 91 buyer. So she ran her usual race, and the Honorable Miss. And I suppose that she'll hang around for the Ballerina. By the way, speaking of the Ballerina, you may have, I'm sure you heard, if you're listening to Andy on Tuesday, and everybody tunes in for that, because, you know, how can you resist? How can anybody resist Andy abusing me for half an hour each week? the conversation that we had, right? Andy had asked me if I knew what was going on with Pretty Mischievous, and I checked after the show with Brendan Walsh. She is running in the Clement Hirsch. So you can tell that they have their designs on the Breeders' Cup distaff with Pretty Mischievous for the rest of the year, right? You know, so she could run in, she could basically run in the Hirsch and then hang around for the Zenyatta and then the distaff. So anyway, that was your Wednesday slate and your Wednesday action to get us going for week three. Today, I'm pretty much done. I actually punched up the Del Mar pick six first today. I wanted to add, I'm kind of excited about it. I'm glad if you listen to the replay, I was really pleased to get Brad Free in here yesterday and get out ahead of it so that you could, you know, you'd get two cracks at it. You know, it's not terrible when we do same day handicapping, but it's, you know, it is preferable. And I got to tell you, the added benefit or the added information provided by National Turf by Andy Harrington, because I you know, when I started playing the West Coast, which ties in directly to the show, actually. I started playing Hollywood and I, you know, found National Turf at that time and still don't approach a card out there without those insights. And of course, Toby Terrell as well with the DRF West Coast Clocker Report. But National Turf is the one that, you know, has been out there the longest. And is just indispensable. And so actually going through that, there was a few, you know, you'll upgrade certain horses, and horses that you thought maybe were borderline, you know, a good report, a good work note, or a bad work note can help you decide. So there were actually a couple of horses that bubbled up a little bit on the radar, including in that nightcap. The nightcap, if you don't want to play the pick six and you're not a multi-race player, in a lot of ways, tonight's eighth race at Del Mar may be the most fun race of the day. Goes off at 8:37 Eastern. It's really a fun race and a really well-matched group of maidens going a mile on the grass. And there are, the way I wrote it up here, I'll tell you what I wrote. Intriguing maiden group where you have a referendum on second-timers, Rowley, Nation, divisible by Sweet Odyssey and Oscar Joy versus those that are piling up losses while running respectably. And that's Quality Wins in Suspense and American Glory. It's a fun race, and I will tell you that as it happens, you talk about work notes, the D'Amato horses that are double-digit prices, that are 15 and 20 to 1. How many opportunities are you going to have to look at Phil D'Amato on the grass at 15 and 20 to 1? And you know, you want the most basic handicapping lesson that there is in the game. The most improvement a horse will show, typically, in their career, in their life, in their racing career, is in their second start. That's, you know, that's one of those. Tom Ainsley probably wrote that at 50 years ago, and you know, there's a lot of things about weight and about, you know, spacing of races that doesn't really apply anymore. But second career start, that will continue to apply. That one's not going away. That's not an old chestnut. It's not a wives' tale, or an old wives' tale, or a middle-aged wives' tale. That's a that's a maxim. So as a result, I'm going to use a five in that nightcap. 1, 3, 7, 9, 10. Rowley, Oscar Joy, Sweet Odyssey, Nation, in Suspense. And I'm going to avoid. This is something Andy cured me of years ago. The horses in Suspense I'm using, but has only made three starts. It's not like in Suspense is, you know, a career maiden, quote unquote, or on his way to being a career maiden. But I side. Typically, you're better off siding with the more lightly raced horses. How about the one the other day? Wasn't necessarily a multi-race topic or a key sequence, but the horse of Grand Motion showed up with that distance race, right? What was it, 1 3/8 the other day? And was a firster in a field that of slow horses, horses that when they write those maiden races at 1 3/16 and 1 3/8, you'll see horses that are plotter types. So you frequently see the comment, may not have to be special, you know, to win at first asking, and Graham showed up with that horse. Was that on Sunday? I can't remember. They begin to run together. All right. Not only are they running together, I'm running on. Let me do a couple of things. Jim Gagliano is going to join us later in the show. And Jim's going to float. I think his visit is tied into a press release today from the Jockey Club for the roundtable. The agenda and some of the highlights. So we'll catch up with Jim Gagliano, who I typically the first summer visit, first chance I get to see Jim during the summers is at Haskell, because of course his career, like Hammer's, they were all there together. Jimmy Ventura and Mike Dempsey and they were all a crowd of. The Young Lions. So we'll talk to Jim. We'll get, it's been 2 weeks. We have not talked on a Thursday to Crafty. Crafty Jeff Franklin is going to join us. We'll get the Win Using Thoroughgraph segment in, and we'll do it on time today, I promise. I do have to try to get to Rich. I'm embarrassed. I have not had a chance. We have not had a chance to talk to Rich Ang, and I'm it's totally my fault. Thursday, late Thursday has become, it's become kind of a funny, crowded scene. We've got we've got the Saratoga Special boys. I don't know which of them is turning up. We'll touch base with Tony. And right now, actually, we're going to go to Iowa. And I, you know, I'm supposed to be in Iowa. But John Moss, who's the former executive director of the Iowa HBPA, and basically the Iowa HBPA is hosting the national convention. And I want to get, I told Eric I got a touch base today, and I mentioned yesterday. I mean, frankly, we would be doing all or mostly HBPA conversations today if I was sitting there at Prairie Meadows. John Moss joins us. John, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good, and I'm embarrassed and feel bad that I'm not sitting there and that you're not sitting across from me.
I don't know if that's no worries. I understand. Flights, this thing has been a little bit more complicated than anybody possibly could have imagined.
It's been a bad 10 days for the transportation system with the IT problems and whatever else. Meanwhile, though, the convention is underway, and as with the Iowa HBPA as the hosts, and I absolutely wanted to give you a chance and everybody out there a chance to, you know, communicate the commitment and you know, and your thoughts.
Well, so far we've had a really good convention. Obviously, other than the travel difficulties that we've had that everybody's been experiencing, but you know, our first days went over very well. A couple of our panels. First one was with talking about the current status report with HISA. Had a number of the attorneys that have kind of been walking through this with us as the national HBPA and as the local affiliates, and just kind of telling us how this thing's going to continue to play out, which I think everybody's kind of up in the air about, truly. You just never know what federal judges are going to do, right? So had a good lengthy conversation about that. We're just going to wait and see how the cards continue to fall out and make decisions as they come about. So, but it was a great panel. We followed that up with a panel on aftercare and had Anna Ford from New Vocations. Also, Kristen Green, who runs the entire racehorse project, and also our local aftercare project, which is called Hope After Racing Thoroughbreds with Dr. Stephanie White. Those three did a bang-up job just walking through all the different various aspects of aftercare within the racing industry, kind of the challenges that everybody has to step up to meet. You know, not only the positive environments, how much, you know, New Vocations just doing such a great job. Their outreach is nationwide. And then obviously the importance of having the RRP and how those guys have really helped make an environment in which horses or thoroughbreds specifically are now wanted and they're marketable and they have a desire to be used and utilized throughout the country. And then finally, also, like I said, talking about Dr. White and HART program and how on a regional, local level, somebody can have a great impact. Even if it's just specific to a single racetrack, such as our location here at Prairie Meadows, you can still really have a big impact and help. And you've got the larger organizations that do their wonderful job, but also the regional aspect of in getting that TAA accreditation and being accredited by TCA, and all the aspects associated with that. It's really good.
The Iowa, you know, one of the things invariably when we get a chance to visit regionally, the Iowa setting and Prairie Meadows and the Iowa breeding program, give us a feel for, you know, for Iowa as, you know, as a stable Mid-American racing environment, and I am curious with what's transpiring on the western end across the border in Nebraska. How do you foresee Mid-American racing in the coming years?
Well, I mean, I'll start off with, you know, horsemen here in Iowa. We have a great relationship with Prairie Meadows, and we have a fantastic relationship with our local legislative body. You know, having those three components working in unison obviously is going to create an environment whereby you can be successful. And right now, we're hitting, I think I'll steal a Mitch McConnell line here, we're punching above our heads. We've got an outstanding breeders program, and it's continuing to grow. We also have an outstanding breeders program, not only in the terms of the numbers, but also the terms of success and the amount of money that, you know, we can provide for our Iowa bred. So those guys are doing really, really well. And that translates regionally. You know, we have one gentleman, Alan Poindexter, who we're actually going to be giving an award to as a living legend here pretty soon, tomorrow. We're going to be talking about some questions, but really, he's done a fantastic job supporting the Iowa bred program, and he's just doing so well in terms of getting his horses out and about all across the country and bringing some just really fabulous animals. But then you also have regional owners that come from Iowa, you know, people such as the Albaugh's, obviously Jerry Crawford having done so well, Maggie Moss, her establishing and starting here as well. And those types of people have really just kind of shown the quality of horsemen and ownership groups that we have that have really kind of went outside the state, done exceptionally well, and just kind of bring that focus back to Iowa in terms of what we can accomplish.
Wow, and those are great. I mean, those are great names, obviously. And it's really notable when you talk about a national level. And I was out at Santa Anita when the card began with, I believe, three straight Poindexter bred winners.
Yes.
Right? It was, and Baffert had one, I know. But it was the craziest thing, you know, and certainly the Iowa bred, you know, there's some Iowa breds that have, you know, shouldered their way into the Graded Stake Company. And then you bring up Dennis Albaugh and Jerry Crawford and Maggie Moss, who basically started on the claiming end and you know, then worked her way, you know, into a, you know, a higher end program. It's been a multi-decade run of sustained success.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly, and I believe it's going to continue. I mean, you know, you have individuals that are committed to continuing to build out and have successful businesses and operations, not only on the breeding, but obviously on the racing side as well, and having that tie back into Iowa. To answer your second part of your question, too, about Nebraska and how they're going to come along, we're looking at this as a rising tide lifts all boats. I'm a little bit biased. I was born and raised in Nebraska. And so Fauna Park is my hometown track, father, you know, trained Leaping Plum. And so wow. I'm really looking forward to them coming back. Hopefully they too punching above their heads at some point in time. We've had some really great horsemen come out of Nebraska over the years, obviously the Vanbergs, et cetera, the Wild Campbells. It's an amazing history there that can't be replicated quite anywhere else. So we look at it as, again, a rising tide lifts all boats. If those that state can come back and they can be successful, we're hoping that there'll be a great tie-in with our racing program and we can all be successful together.
In terms of the calendar and melding, you know, one of the topics that is frankly been a little vexing, and it was something I would have liked to, if I was going to be there, I was going to be moderating the group of racing secretaries and racing directors.
Yes.
Well, one of the topics is the challenges with the declining fall crop numbers of scheduling a program, particularly a stakes program, that doesn't offer, you know, too many similar opportunities, you know, in the various divisions. and that overlap. How is the schedule? And of course, Fonner starts in the winter, so it you know, in terms of the Nebraska schedule, it you know, it would be a nice lead-in. I just am curious, you know, with Fonner to, you know, to Prairie, and then maybe in the fall, Columbus and you know, some of the we don't even know how many tracks do we expect in Nebraska when this is all done.
Well, you're correct. Those are all things we're actually taking into consideration to see how big they actually are going to be able to come be eventually with their purses being increased, obviously. How many horses is that going to actually draw? I mean, right now, just a little bit of background, two things. Racing and Gaming Commission here is heavily involved in our industry, of course, but they're in the process of doing a year and a half long study, trying to see what are some of the things we should be doing here in the not-too-distant future to try and improve racing, or things that we can improve upon to make it better. And part of that's being done by Doug Reed. I think many people know him.
Sure.
Former U of A racetrack industry program director for many, many years. But him and a couple of his gentlemen that are doing the study, and we're looking to have the results out here in August. But they're going to be looking at some of that flow. What are some of the opportunities? One of the, you know, kind of doing that classic SWOT analysis. What are some of those strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats that are floating out there that we can take advantage of, try to avoid? What are the pitfalls of maybe working with Nebraska? What are the strengths of working with Nebraska in their schedule? But that also applies for the other regional states as well, Oklahoma, Texas, Arkansas. How do horses flow up? Do they come from New Mexico? Do they come from, you know, other Arkansas, you know, Texas? When do they come? If they come, how long do they stay? When do they leave? Do they fold into Nebraska? So we're looking at a whole bunch of different options. And obviously the big question that everybody's thinking about and wondering about too is Canterbury Park, and how well they're going to have, how successful they're going to be in terms of a long term. We're hoping that they're going to be able to pass some legislation up there, of course, that brings them back into a strength position since their contract ended here, I believe, in 2022 with the local tribe up there for marketing and purse revenue distributions.
Right.
But they're facing a few challenges up there. But we're always talking and trying to help out our local horsemen. Once again, trying to push every rising tide lifts all boats. So it's not good to see racetracks go away. We want to see more come online and try to increase those breeds and increase the popularity of the sport and bring more owners back into the fold.
Well, and you know, we talked on Monday to Jim Watkins at Fairmont, and Jim is there, of course, attending, and you know, their future you know, seems stable and assured. I mean, the Mid-American, you know, for people that grew up on either coast and who you know, the reference of Mid-American racing that essentially was Nebraska, you know, up to Illinois, down, you know, down through and technically in the winter, you know, down to Oaklawn, Kentucky, technically part of that, you know, that historic element of Mid-American racing. It really was a bedrock for the game. And, you know, the situation in Chicago is you know, has been sad and frustrating for, you know, for Illinois breeders. And I mean, it at the same time, you know, what's I don't want to say awkward about it, John, but what is you know, true is that other regions, you know, when there's an issue the way things happened in Chicago, I mean, the obvious beneficiary has been Horseshoe, Indianapolis.
Yes, But I think that's a short-term gain. I don't believe, you know, and I'm just talking anecdotally here.
Sure.
But I always see and view those things as short-term gains. I don't know as if those play out long-term. You might have seen a little bit of a bump, but is that going to play out in 5 years? Is that going to play out in 10 years? Are those people going to move down there and stay in the industry? it's still not going to be as impactful overall as having that racetrack stay where it was, continuing to employ the local fan base, or continuing to employ the local employment base, and then engaging with that local fan base. It's really hard when racetrack disappears from an environment. Again, having grown up with Exarban disappearing, that was my my summertime track.
Sure.
I was 16 when they ran the last race out there, and in the ensuing now almost 30 years, 28 years now this year, it's had an impact. Omahans recognized it. They understood that that was not probably in their best interest. Obviously, I'm supportive of them coming back, but it did have an impact economically there. And while it did have a small bump regionally for Prairie Meadows, and I, quite frankly, was part of that bump for Prairie Meadows. My father quit training, and, you know, he made that kind of that connection. He started running from Fauner Park, come to Prairie Meadows, and he go back east during the winter, during the fall and winter. But it's still small, right? It's not a long-term success story in terms of what you can continue to accomplish if you have what you have and continue to reinvest in it and make sure that it's thriving and successful. So, well, yes, Indiana might have bumped up short-term. I don't know if that's a long-term. It's definitely not a long-term plan anybody should be reliant upon, let me put it that way.
Well, the stability is the key, because that's what breeders rely on. Knowing that the program is etched in stone, and that the funds will be there, the breeders' awards, the people that are investing in the game from that end, and we need two things, we need owners, breeders, and we need horse players. I mean, those are the two things, and when you lose a market, when you lose, you think about, we're talking Mid-American Racing used to include Detroit, where you had Hazel and you had DRC.
Yeah.
I mean, it was that was a terrific market, and to lose Michigan, and even the little what was the Meadows track, Mount, was it Mount Pleasant? What was it called?
I'm not sure. It's been a while.
MPM, yes. I think. But to lose New England, I mean, to lose Boston.
Yes.
People from New England come here to Saratoga. So it's within reach, but not like having Lincoln, Narragansett, Rockingham, and Suffolk. If there isn't proximity to it, and people, can't be introduced to live racing, it's problematic for us long term.
I fully agree. I mean, I understand tracks are looking at, the on track handle is not something that we talk about that much, only in terms of usually negative, because it's typically down, especially with some of the local smaller tracks. But you can still get a fan base out. And engaging, that's how you, at least in my opinion, I know some people are able to watch the horses on TV and make a connection then. They watch some race and they really get engaged. But it seems like the horse players, many of them that I've encountered, somebody brought them out as a friend or family member and engaged them, and they're on track. And just having that on-track experience cannot be replicated.
No.
And it's just vital to have that connection, being able to stand there and watch the horses run by, or be able to, shout on for the horse that's carrying your colors, in whatever it is, whatever degree it is, to get them involved. It's so important. And for us as horsemen, that's where we get our ownership a lot of times from, too. It really all plays into it together, because we're pulling from so many different groups that they jump into this just based on having been out to the track. Somebody helped them. Somebody showed them how to make a $2 bet. Somebody showed them how to get their first exacta down. And it all plays in together. So if we don't have the horse players that hopefully turn into owners, or you got super competitive individuals that want to jump into horse ownership, kind of separate outside of that, it makes it really tough for us as a sport to even go in a circle. You got to have the horse players and the owners, otherwise we don't have anything to actually do.
100%. I completely agree. And when we heard in recent years, with, you know, some people saying, well, we don't need the C tracks. Hold on. You absolutely need those tracks, because the first time people come to the races, they don't know the difference between a 10-claimer and the Kentucky Derby. It's the pageantry is there, the excitement level, the winning money, seeing everything that's involved, the experience, it doesn't matter at what level. Just like, I always make the parallel, John, to the minor leagues and the stupidity of baseball to eliminate, right, yes, the minor league teams. You don't get it. Not everybody in Iowa, for instance, it can go to St. Louis and spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars to see the Cardinals. But they can go see the Midwest League AA team, Iowa Cubs.
We got a AAA team here, the Iowa Cubs, and I tell you what, we work with them. Even last year, we were able to get free general admission tickets for all our horsemen. So it all plays together.
Yep.
And you're trying to keep that local fan base, keep them engaged. So if they want to participate, either continue to participate at your level, or, you know, go on and do something different. Everybody's got their level of entrance and their risk reward, their barrier to entry that they have to make those adjustments for. And we're just happy that we're continuing to be strong here in Iowa. Kind of back to your comment about having these things locked in, which is something we've done here. You know, our purses are locked in at minimum amounts, minimum race days. And it gives us some flexibility to do some different things. Like right now, we're kind of running a mixed meet where we run quota horses at a couple races, and then we have thoroughbred racing for the vast majority of the card. But it gives us flexibility. So the breeders do know that this money's going to be here. They're going to be able to participate, and that they're going to have a sound program. Now, we might not have a contract immediately with the racetrack every couple of years, but that's kind of – it's important, and it's important, but the vitality is that those monies are guaranteed. Those things have to happen. So it does bring that stability that everybody needs. And kind of circling back to the fan base and people coming out to racetracks, one of the things we've noticed in the last couple of years, post-COVID, I will tell you what, in terms of on-track attendance, for us, it's skyrocketed. And I'm not sure if it forced people, since we continued to race during COVID in 2020, but nobody could be inside. Everybody could be out on the apron. It really made a connection with a lot of the local younger generation. If you come out to our paddock, or if you come out to the paddock, come out to the apron on a Friday or Saturday night, I'm going to tell you, the average age out there cannot, if you're doing averages, it can't be above 40. There are so many young people to come out,
nice,
want to watch and participate. Now, I'm not bringing out somebody who's getting 20 or 30,000 people, but I can have at least 1,000 or 2,000 people on track on the apron out here at Prairie Meadows. But you keep doing that day in, day out, you're going to start generating some fans. You're going to generate some interest. So it's very positive for us. We're very happy.
Well, and they've done an amazing job up at you mentioned Canterbury earlier. Canterbury has cultivated, an average 7,500 gate fauner. You see in the middle of the winter, people
yes,
turning out at fauner like crazy. In fact, the other day, speaking of Fairmont, I can't help but call it Fairmont instead of FanDuel, but
yes,
Jim sent a picture that they had a gorgeous day in Collinsville, and they had a big throng. It's a bargain. It's bargain entertainment. It makes, so many, there's so many positives, obviously, John. John, talk a little bit as well. Some of the other topics, Pat Cummings is going to join us next. Pat's going to do a CAW conversation in a couple of hours, but had that session yesterday with Hammer and Andy Schweigert and David O'Farrell that was about filling races and the condition books. There was sort of the social interaction and social media age conversation as well that Jenny Reese handled, which had Anise Montplaisir, who we've had on from Amplify Horse Racing, which is a an outreach, an educational initiative that is fabulous, that reaches for a younger audience. And then the upstart Light Up Racing that came out of Australia and basically is a quick response team, something, frankly, we've called for years to have, you know, to answer in the public eye questions where, you know, anti-racing forces have utilized, you know, their public relations tools in an effort against racing. Well, Light Up is the countermeasure, you know, to basically answer, you know, any smears and you know, the misinformation that's out there. A topic that needs to, both of these areas, you know, are topical and you know, au courant, as they say.
No, you're right. We've had a couple of those panels that actually occurred yesterday with Amplify Horse Racing and Light Up Racing. Jenny did a fantastic job moderating, as she always does. You know, she's a I know she's won Eclipse Awards, but sometimes thinks that she gets she's just underappreciated at times. She just does such a fantastic job. We're really appreciative of her work, and especially when she did moderate this panel with the Light Up and Amplify. Both those organizations are so kind of in their infancy, and so it was very interesting hearing what they're going to do and how they're trying to continue to do, as you just say, especially with Amplify, trying to be a quick response team to some of the negative comments that are out there and everything that kind of revolves around racing. They've had some pretty good outreach, it looks like, thus far. We're looking to see how they continue to be successful in the future in terms of garnering additional support. It sounds like they're definitely trying to get things figured out, responding, and they're trying to hone in on their message and figure out how to and what things to respond to the best to and quickly to. It seemed as though aftercare is one of those areas that everybody continuously we try to talk about and increase, and I think that's maybe an area that they're continuing to work on. And the same with Amplify Racing, trying to talk about the positives that are in the horse racing industry from a younger perspective and increase that awareness of what we do to our animals, how these animals are treated, what that looks like in the short term, in the long term. And they also created a partnership with the Illinois Thoroughbred Horsemen Association, the ITHA, over there in Hawthorne this year, kind of bringing kids out, exposing them to the racetrack environment and trying to increase that awareness starting at such a young age. We've seen those programs in the past. We've always thought that those were very successful, and we're glad that they're continuing to do that. But it was a good Q&A for us to try and learn more about both those organizations. So it was a good panel. Moving back on to the panel regarding kind of the art of classifying and filling races, Pat did a good job kind of discussing what they're thinking about. And I know this is it's almost kind of a rehash of a panel that RTIP, Racetrack Industry Program, did a few years back, which talked about, and I believe, and now I might be misquoting here, but I believe they started doing this a little bit with standardbred racing, effectively whereby you assign a number to the horse based on how it's been running. And whatever that number is, you know, let's say it's not quite a buyer number, is my impression at this point, but it's a number of some sort that kind of gives you an indication, almost a classification of where this animal could be. My own personal interpretation, this is almost like the Greyhound grading scale. Not quite the same. Anybody right. Who's accustomed to Greyhound racing, you got A, B, C, D, E, and you had to run at the different levels. And if you ran so often, you go up a level. If you didn't do so well, you drop back down to a B or C level, depending on where the dog ran. It almost feels a little bit like that. And it wasn't a bad scoring system. It's going to be interesting as to how that gets implemented and doesn't necessarily replace the claiming game. It's more of a complement, I believe, is the way that it's being portrayed right now, to give owners an opportunity, not necessarily to worry about their horse getting claimed, but so much as allowing their horse to run against what effectively should be very equal competition. What I'm hoping is, and I believe this is, I didn't hear this yesterday, but again, previously at the U of A, that the odds for the bettors, the payouts actually started to go up, at least in the standard bred racing, which means that there should be a greater level of equality there, in so much as if you're not getting 1-5 shots and you're not getting 2-1 shots, you're getting horses that are going off 3, 4, 5, 6 to 1 that are winning because all the horses in the race are going off at 3, 4, 5 to 1. You've created a parity. And that's what I think bettors are looking for. Larger fields that are competitive fields where they try to find an angle, but you're getting 8 horses in that race. And they're all relatively close. And it makes it a difficult or more difficult and a challenging opportunity for somebody who's a true handicapper. And they can appreciate those types of races. I think that's what the goal is, partially with this, along with owners being able to place their horses in the races where they think they have a legitimate chance. And they don't have to deal with somebody that might not, you know, you're not running, you know, I've got my horse in there, the race, you know, gets drawn, program come overnight comes out, and I'm looking at a 1-9 shot going, son of a gun, I didn't even know this horse is able to go into this race. I didn't think he necessarily qualified, and all of a sudden you got some monster in there, regardless if it's claiming or even allowance races sometimes that it happened to you. So it's an interesting concept. It sounds as though a few jurisdictions are close to pulling the trigger in terms of being able to offer that. There are, you know, they talked about the algorithm being created. I did have questions about kind of removing bias in terms of the creation of that. Typically, those biases have more or less revolved around, you know, human bias in regards to, you know, facial recognition systems right now currently or still or at this point have been known to not work very well on certain races of people. And they think that's 100% attributable to bias in terms of the algorithm because it's people that create these things. So there's a learning curve there. And I asked as to whether or not how they're going to account for removing that bias. The bias that I see is different racetracks maybe having different numbers associated with them, even though the horses are actually generally should have a different number assigned to them. So I'm not sure how that's going to play out. Maybe it's not as big of a deal, but it's something that I do think about in terms of when they create this, what type of bias is going to be implied or implicit based on the track, based on the location. Maybe if it's a regional bias or a track bias. I mean, I've heard such things anecdotally about buyer speed figures for years, but now we're going to have an actual rhythm or algorithm that's supposed to crank out a number. And so I wonder if they're going to be able to eliminate that bias in that process as well.
Well, we'll talk tomorrow. Rick Hammerly will give us, and Rick has hinted about this concept for ages. This has been a long time coming, this project.
Yes, and it'll be, like I said, it'll be interesting to see. I just worry about those components. And then there's, you know, you're also worried about, you know, some of the concepts that, you know, things that nobody wants to talk about. But frankly, I worry about nefarious individuals trying to maybe game a system also in terms of, you know, maybe not giving forth best effort to try and knock a horse's calculated number down a little bit so that they can be in competition with an easier field, depending on how that plays out. That does, you know, nobody's saying it doesn't happen now. I'm just worried about, you know, from a horseman's side, if we're really trying to create parity, which is what claim and gain really was supposed to do in the first place. You know, $10,000 horses are all supposed to be $10,000 horses. If somebody drops a $30,000 horse in their $10,000 race, you're going to be able to take that horse out of there, right? You're going to be able to claim it. They might get the win, but they're also going to lose the horse. The whole idea was is that that makes you or forces you not to run them too low. But that's not the case with a number being assigned. So the question then becomes, what level of security or insecurity do we have when we assign these numbers? And how long does it take to generate a number? Is it one that's based over a couple of races? Is it over a lifetime? How do those numbers get created? So, you know, it's an interesting concept, and it may work, it may not work. I'm interested to see how it plays out, but those are some of the questions that I have kind of on the front end in terms of going forth with the rollout of that particular concept.
Well, and it's a major, it would be a major departure, obviously, and it'll take some adjusting, but it's something that the other regions of the country, Australia notably, has used successfully, it's something that, again, it's how the game is perceived from outside, you know, our friendly confines, as it were. You know, we're a rather insular industry, and so the fact that one of our most basic operating elements needs to be addressed and altered in this manner, it's an upheaval. It'll be an upheaval. It'll be different, but it's people seem to be adjusting to it, and that's one of the reasons. You know, I know a lot of people think that, oh, these gatherings, we're having to talk to Jim Gagliano at the end of the show about the roundtable, the symposium, and when we have these get-togethers, they're important because they allow for the opportunity to disseminate, these conversations, and for then, the heads of the regional chapters to go out and communicate it, to their constituents, who can then, get it to the trainers and get it to the owners. It's a natural information flow, and it's vital. I mean, it's the only way. It's really the only way for us to move forward, collectively.
No, it's obviously here in Iowa and listening to these things, it's very curious. It's also part of the grand scheme, of being able to roll things out in little areas of regionally, as you say, or even track by track, to see how some of these things play out. That's what's nice about having a state-run individual system, is you can get into that and realize, this tweet might not have been the best idea that we've ever had. We need to roll this back. Or, if it works out well, everybody else will then emulate it. But it gives you a chance. It's as you just said, upheaval's good to a degree, so long as it doesn't create such a cacophony of issues that it takes down an entire industry. I'm not saying that's the case here, but those are the types of things that we've always talked about, is having the little micro environments where you can test out a new thought, test out a new idea, see if it catches on, see if there's some merit to it. It's really nice to be able to do that. And again, if a rule change or a change in the wagering or a new race type comes out that everybody wants to emulate, and then they can go forth and go throughout the rest of the country, it really has a positive impact.
Well, the opportunity to touch on the topics at large and the rest of the way this afternoon and into tomorrow. Then there'll be a night at the races on Friday night at Prairie. And, John, I appreciate the opportunity to check in. I wish I was there. It's the first one I've missed in years. But thank you. And thanks to everybody for the work that's gone into this.
Well, I really appreciate it, Steve. Again, wish that you could have been here also. I think you would have found the panels fascinating as well. The computer robotic wagering, that's going to be a computer assisted wagering topic that's going to be coming up later today. That's just absolutely fascinating to us as horsemen, just in general, sitting back and listening to how that plays out. The continued, everybody, we all see it, but what the gates open to board changes drives everybody insane, I think. So it'll be a good discussion today. And yes, we wish you're out here and you could have listened to that directly, but really appreciate you giving a call. And we're here in Iowa. We had Lieutenant Governor speak yesterday and just kind of talking about how wonderful racing is as an impact in our state, and and racing in general for the entire country. I mean, sometimes we forget, but we got to root for the industry as a whole and how much we have an impact on the daily lives of so many people out there. So it's a great industry to be in.
No doubt. Well, John, I appreciate the chance to talk. John Moss, who is the former head of the Iowa HBPA, who, of course, is the host of the National HBPA Convention this week, and continues. We're going to talk to Pat, actually. Pat Cummings is going to join us, and we'll talk. We haven't talked CAW in the last couple of months, but we started the conversation literally 15 years ago on the show, and and have been sent out the drum beating early on. It's a very, very difficult topic to address, and how to back out the percentage that it now represents of the total handle. And the industry, I say this every time the topic is broached, Maury Wolf warned the industry in 2000 that there had to be a stopgap, a fail-safe percentage that we couldn't allow them to cross, and they crossed it probably 10 years ago. So we only have ourselves to blame. John, thank you, and we'll continue to keep tabs on what's going on at the convention. Thank you.
Very much. Thank you, Steve. You have a good rest of your day.
John Moss, everybody, from the Iowa HBPA. Going to get Pat in here, and should mention we had a couple other topics, again, on the betting side. It's not just limited to the CAW discussion. Fixed odds panel that's going on just about now, actually. Our friend Michelle Fisher is moderating it. Update on where things stand with fixed odds, and you can't discuss this kind of topic like CAW without Pat Cummings. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Where were we recently? I saw you for a second, and we didn't get a chance to talk, and then I never saw you again.
Yeah, Saratoga, I think.
No, it was earlier than that. It was before that. It was something. Maybe it was last week, opening week. But I could have sworn.
No, you didn't see me there. I was thinking Belmont, Saratoga.
Oh, maybe that might have been. That makes sense. And then I looked again for you, and I never saw. I didn't see you.
I don't disappear in many places. But
that's true. It's a good point. It's a fair point. I felt awful about not being able to be there, but I wanted to bring the topics at large forward. And in about an hour and a half, Dan Ross is going to moderate a CAW panel discussion, and you and our friend Dave Basler from Ohio, I think Jack Jazorski, I think too, is on that one. And sponsored by Oklahoma and Nebraska. And we have not, I've not had a chance to catch up with you in I don't know, probably 90 days or more. And of course, doing the work, the latest work, the initiatives that you and Mike Rapoli are working on. But, the original Thoroughbred Idea Foundation topics, that you spent tremendous amount of time analyzing and interpreting for the industry at large, and the CAW issue was really a major topic and a linchpin for you for discussions.
Yeah, and thanks for that, Steve. It was a labor for a lot of years, and there were a lot of naysayers along the way that doubted information we were obtaining and analysis that we were doing, but I think it's really kind of come full circle, and there's a much greater recognition of the state of it all. And another panel here today talking to the horsemen and the horsemen's groups about this particular topic, because the horsemen play a pivotal role in contract negotiation, right, with the wagering provider, with the bet takers, for not just ordinary customers, but for all potential remote locations, and what rate is going to be charged to them. So, you know, I actually think the horsemen are really the linchpin in potentially helping force and negotiate meaningful change in this space, right? It's not just the operator here. It's the horsemen, because they have contract signatory rights, and exercising those rights, you know, I think a lot of, you know, if we go back to our industry with Satish Sinha topics from 15 plus years ago, Satish was regularly discussing the contract negotiation process. And there were frequent outages, if you will, where signals were withheld by horsemen and occasionally by the track operators, and deals could not be met. We saw a very brief snapshot of that, a rare modern instance of it recently between Naira and FanDuel. And the whole point on that discussion was the impact of source market fees. Most people don't realize what that was all about, but New York customers of ADWs are charged through their ADW provider an extra 5% if they're using an out-of-state-based ADW. Now, the customer itself isn't charged. The ADW is charged. So if you're betting a 12% base takeout bet through your TwinSpires, ExpressBet, AmWager, you know, your non-Naira or your non-OTB-based ADW account, that ADW is charged 5% on your handle. So it makes it less compelling, less profitable for the ADW to want to take that bet. And in some cases of extremely low takeout bets, they may say, you know, maybe we're not interested. Maybe we're not going to let you offer that particular bet type. Or they lose over time. And so, you know, there's a lot of machinations within that. There's a lot of political issues that are tied to that. And look, frankly, a lot of that doesn't get talked about in public, but it does have an issue and an effect. And the role of horsemen in this is, you know, I think it's been undercooked to this point, but there's an opportunity to really step forward and say, horsemen, you need to be looking at wagering reports and see how your customers are doing. How are your mass market customers performing? How are your ordinary rank and file horse players performing in the exacta pool, the trifecta pool, the superfecta pool? How are they? Adam Koenig walking past me right now, Steve. I just had to, you know, avid at the races with Steve Bick listener and former chairman of the Licensing Occupation Administrative Regulation Committee in the House in the great Commonwealth of Kentucky. And he sends along his best. And of course, he is a champion of the horse players himself for his tremendous work in getting the penny breakage bill through. So you know, look and see how our customers performing, right? And if you see that the, let's just take TwinSpires as an example. If you see Naira Bets customers, that mass market customers are losing 30% on their trifectas, and the takeout rate is 22%, that's a significant underperformance from the takeout rate, right? If they're losing 40% in supers and the takeout's 25%, it's a significant underperformance to what you would expect to see the loss actually be. And what is the effect of the algorithmic player, the CAW players, the top 10 that are betting hundreds of millions a year each, the next tier betting tens of millions of dollars a year each, turning profits? And what effect does this have on ordinary players and whether or not they come back to play, right? These are all issues that I think have been woefully unaddressed for a really long period of time. And getting horsemen engaged in the research and the analytics is really, I think, vitally important. And Eric Hamelbeck has recognized that and promoted that topic amongst his membership. And based on my years of work in this space, I'm really appreciative of it. And I think horse players should be too. and we need to see action, of course. But it's great to at least be talking about it in this space.
Without getting too far in the weeds, how does the IHA, the Interstate Horse Racing Act, and the Wire Act, how does that play into this? Explain what leverage can be applied to essentially implore the ADWs to claw back and to more or less trim the sails.
That legislation underpins all of the transactions that have enabled simulcasting growth.
Right.
So in order for a track to export its signal across state lines, horse racing got this exemption in the late 1970s that enables cross interstate betting. However, it requires the approval of both the track and the representative horsemen's group. So if that approval is withheld, the signal cannot be distributed. Again, in the turn of the century, the turn of the millennium, we saw this happen a lot more frequently when, the role of the OTBs and host fees was slightly different. But as there was a point in time, let's say back then, when maybe ADW handle was 5%, right? The early days of the U-bets, and their emergence into the space, it was nascent. It grew very slowly. And then it became the fastest growth point for the sport. But what I think a very important point that is often forgotten here is that as purse supplements from other forms of gaming came into the space and were helping prize money, it became a little easier to lose sight of the effect on horse playing, on wagering overall, on the rates, on the discussions. It was sort of, that was extra money, whereas the purse supplements became sort of purse primaries, if you will. But there's a law that underlies all of this, and that the horsemen have the ability to exercise in their ongoing negotiations, right? This is the same discussion point that has cropped up in Dan Ross's reporting from TDN, which is part of the reason why he's here to moderate today, of how the TOC interacts with the California tracks and the negotiations that are done there for what rates all the different players are playing. Takeout rates in California are set through statute. It's not easy to change that. But the negotiation goes on between horsemen, as represented by the TOC, the tracks, and what sort of customers they want in their pools and at what rates. I had a chance to just chat with Ron Moquette last night and today, and Ron was talking with pride about just how much of the handle at Oaklawn Park is coming in the show pool with the show pool bonus. I think he said something to the effect of nearly 20% of all handle from Oaklawn on track is in the show pool, right? High churn, the bonus that they pay, it has an effect of essentially eliminating breakage. It doesn't entirely, but it has that in some cases, I think it's actually even more than that. In trying to drive churn, let customers give them a path to winning a little bit more and the importance thereof. And I know Ron, through the Arkansas HBPA, is, proud of that. So, yeah, it's a fun discussion. It needs to continue to evolve more. I know right now they're talking about the growth and the role of fixed odds in the overall landscape. And, that's been an ongoing discussion and how that can come into the space more. I know it's been a slow go for a lot of people, but I think there's a lot of hope too that can emerge and grow.
Hey, Pat, out of curiosity, and I don't know how closely you're monitoring it, to the extent that you were doing the TIP work. But how effective, and I suppose this is one of those areas that, you know, the information is always a little murky and a little incomplete, and you got to, you know, you got to do some forensic accounting. But there are people that do that. You know, Joe Applebaum has you know, had initiatives in this arena to try to, you know, help understand where the, you know, the handle source and where the growth can come from, where there's, if there's slippage, etc. But what I'm leading up toward is how effective has the retail only concept been? And Naira is the one that is the most prominent in this area. But do we have a feel for, you know, what the actual, you know, bump is, or what the effect is of things like the, you know, the late multis, the cross country pick five is retail only, etc. Most of the big pick X's are. Any thoughts on that, or any feel for that?
The thoughts are mostly ones of frustration, because it is almost impossible for the the person without access to that information to be able to make a determination. And so it really does rely on either the track operator or the representative horseman's group, which, mind you, of course, Joe was doing it from that perspective and understanding the numbers and talking about it. I will tell you this, you know, if you ask me the question of what has been the reaction to the increased attention in the CAW space, you know, have you noticed anything in terms of information becoming available, or, you know, what's actually transpired out of all of the research, all of the reporting? It's been steps backwards, Steve. I pursued public information requests with the state of Florida for several years. They were fulfilling those requests. And then once information was published and that brought to light, for whatever reason, can't explain it, that information dried up. You know, responses to inquiries were not returned. In California, Oliver Reeder of the Financial Times brought to light the information that had been published by the California Horse Racing Board for 15 years without controversy. And within 2 to 3 weeks of the Financial Times publishing that story, that information went away and was changed and has been changed going forward. Now, I've got all that information saved from those 15 years where the CHRB didn't seem to think there was any problem, nor did any of their wagering partners. But you know, that is literally the most direct sign of the impact of the discussion, that the information that was public and available has been changed. It has become less public in the aftermath. Now, that's unfortunate, and it gives people a reason to think that there is something being hidden or something to hide. And I feel the complete opposite about that. You should not be embarrassed about the use of technology in the space. We should be encouraging more people to move to and to embrace technology in their assessment, in their wagers, and find a balance between a modern approach that may, in fact, use algorithms to be betting. There's plenty of that going on in all different spaces. This is how the financial markets have evolved, right? This is how people like, you know, one of the leading horse owners in America, Vinny Viola, made a tremendous amount of money, right, in expanding high-frequency trading and high-frequency trading access. Again, it's modern, it's technology, it's evolution. But you need to balance it with mass customer appeal and making the sport approachable and engageable and not a frustrating endeavor on a regular basis. And to their credit, NYRA making the decision now, I believe this will now be 3 years of cutting off CAWs inside of 2 minutes to post in the wind pool. Without question, the NYRA wind pool is the most stable wind pool in America. If you don't want to be crushed by late odds changes, if you want to have confidence, then inside of 2 minutes to post, you can be pretty sure that the prices, you're not going to have an instance, or very rarely will you have an instance, of a horse going from 20 to 1 to 8 to 1. But that's commonplace across America, day in and day out. And keep in mind, the wind pool is the smallest pool by participation for most of these groups, right? The CAWs are often the smallest percentage, you know, maybe 15, 18% of the wind pool, whereas in the super exotics, tri supers, fours and fives, they can be in excess of 40%. In fact, I had one HBPA rep here tell me that in his state, that the CAWs are now approaching 40% of all the handle in that state. And recognizing this is a situation that needs to be addressed. There needs to be a better balance. And it's not been a miracle overnight. You know, you need to take some steps. It will not be perfect, but you know, it can be controlled. Horsemen have that power to do so. But I think it's very embraceable to have select pools by which the CAWs are cut off at a certain point. And for as much as people want to lament late odds changes in the wind pool, trust me, if you could see all the tri and super probables, I can tell you, it's got to be much worse, right? You know, this super paid light. Well, you know what? Maybe in the 20 seconds before the race went off, it was going to pay five times more than what it did, right? Yeah, it paid light all right. It got crushed. It doesn't come close to some of the wind pool changes that we see. But that's because the CAWs are a much bigger portion of those exotic pools. But finding a space for those sorts of, I'd say, approachable, managed, balanced efforts to give mass market players a better experience. I mean, it's like it's customer service 101, right? You have different types of customers. You have to treat some of them differently in some respects, but you don't want it to be at the expense of another set of customers. Yeah. And I think that's what's happened.
Well, and that's it's funny. I'll give you a example. You know, ripped from literally from today's headlines, which involves Southwest, who apparently now is going to change up and start to pay, you know, allow flyers to pay for premier seating, and they're gonna devote a third of the planes to a premium cabin, there's been plenty of immediate outcry by the core customer who you know has been flying Southwest for decades. I've talked about my experience moving to Kansas City and discovering them in the 80s and flying to Chicago from Kansas City for $19 each way.
Unbelievable.
Girlfriend and I would go for dinner, literally. We'd fly to Chicago for dinner. There's your example. They may be appealing to a certain new demographic. They're trying
and
to.
You know the likely reaction to this, Steve, is that some other airline could end up trying to take that space, right?
Yeah.
And someone's going to try and capitalize on that, and I'm sure Southwest has probably calculated some degree of that. But they decide that, you know, this particular area may be a little more profitable, but it's going to open up another opportunity. And racing's parallel to this, of course, is the ongoing expansion of legal sports betting, right? The availability, the ease, and the assurance of price stability, you know, the price you bet is the price you get, is very attractive to a lot of people. There's tremendous mass market influence from sports betting operators in 38 states. And it's just so much easier now to bet something other than horse racing. Has horse racing kept pace? Of course the answer is no, right? We had a legal monopoly on internet-based wagering essentially for the entirety of the internet era up until about 2018, right? And our business shrunk by half. We need to be better. And incremental change is still positive change, right? We're not going to do it overnight. But horse players, you know, you need to find ways to build, sustain your customer base. And a lot of the decisions that have occurred over the years have actually helped erode our customer base. And that's the thing I think that is drives the frustration of many horse players across the country. And it manifests itself in things like the argument about the role of CAWs. And just about every criticism that is leveled against them is warranted and understandable.
Pat Cummings.
So I get it, and I've gotten it for a lot of years.
No, well, for sure. You know, one of the people that we reach to for these, you know, kinds of conversations. In addition to today's presentation, Pat, what else have you gleaned, and what did you find compelling yesterday as a kickoff?
I'll tell you, you know, the feedback on two different sessions was just exceptional. One was discussing the growth in the aftercare space. Anna Ford from New Vocations, Kirsten Green from the Retired Racehorse Project, giving updates on the state of aftercare and where they are in their different programs, and a tremendous amount of feedback from the different horsemen's associations about programs they're working with and success stories they've had and how that space has evolved. And then the other was in new initiatives like Amplify and Light Up Racing,
yeah. And
the impact that they're having. And I know that there's one horseman's group in particular that's worked directly with Amplify to build educational initiatives out in Chicago, in Cicero, tied into Hawthorne, and the Illinois THA working with Amplify to run summer programs for high school students out there. It's been really successful.
Nice.
So there was a lot of good uptake there. And you know, look, my work for the last 7 months with Mike Rapoli's nascent National Thoroughbred Alliance has focused very much on aftercare. Mike tweeted about it this morning. You know, we're working on both a transaction-based funding model and a strategy for the next decade of American aftercare, right? It's a bit of a chicken and an egg. Some of the conversations we have are focused on where the money's coming from and how much it's going to take. And some of the conversations are focused on what's going to happen with it. How's it going to work? And we need to kind of work in both lanes in parallel. We're talking to sales companies. We're talking to the big breeding farms. We're talking to horsemen. Everyone's going to need to participate at a bigger level because funding has plateaued in this space and everything is more expensive. So it's still great that a lot of these organizations are getting the funding that they are from things like the TAA and the TCA, but it is not enough. And we need to take American aftercare efforts to the next level. By no means does it mean we haven't done well. We've done great. This is a shining American success story in thoroughbred racing. The American, the TAA has done a fantastic job in elevating standards across the aftercare space, but we need to now take it to the next level. And it's been incredibly energizing working in that space, and we're continuing to evolve our plan, and you're going to hear more about it in the future.
Did the SAFE Act come up?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it feels like there's a renewed momentum, which is great, to potentially just eliminate the ability to export horses for slaughter. Now, there's been a tremendous amount of success, Steve, in reducing the number of horses exported for slaughter. Probably reduced about 90% in 10 years, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's unbelievable. But to think that it still exists because about $12 million a year in horse flesh is sent to Mexico is ridiculous. I mean, the aftercare space alone is generating over $200 million in economic impact, right? And we still have $12 to $15 million worth of economic impact for horses being sent. It's unbelievable that this still exists. And, you know, bringing a true end to slaughter, kind of taking that next step to eliminate that final 10%, is really what we need to be doing. And the SAFE Act is just so logical and so needed. And I've heard a lot of positive momentum in the space, and I'm really hoping we can help get that over the line too.
Well, and our go-to there is animal lobbyist Chris Hyde. We'll get an update
from Chris. Yeah,
Chris
is great.
Chris is tireless and just has come close a few times. There's a handful of ranchers that have got congressmen in their pocket that have stymied this at the 11th hour repeatedly. It's disgusting.
Think about this though, Steve. We have seen a reduction in the number of horses sent on export to slaughter by 140,000 in 10 years.
Yeah.
Okay, 140,000. And have you caught the stories about all the bad cases that are out there in America? Like, what are we going to do? How are we possibly going to absorb this? We did it.
Yeah.
The industry did it, right?
Yeah.
This has been remarkably successful, but it's still, the job is not done. And Chris has worked on this. Look, a lot of organizations have been involved in this, but it has just not gotten over the line. And the thoroughbred space, I think, really needs to step up and help push it over.
Well, the thoroughbred side has been proactive and very supportive.
100%.
It's not good form for me to throw a different breed, a different racing breed under the bus. But I 90% of the horses that do end up in that pipeline, going
correct
south and north to the abattoir, are a different breed, and yet we're the ones that are shouldering, the insult and the smears. It's a little frustrating, to be honest, but
it, very much so. And I said this yesterday after one of the sessions here. If we get slaughter to zero, if we get equine racetrack fatalities to zero, we can sit there and be very proud of that. But you know what? Someone is still going to find a video of some horse somewhere across America or the world, and we are still going to get hit for it. So you have to be relentless. You cannot stop in the efforts to improve our space, to improve public perception of racing, and to actually take that perception and turn it into reality.
Right.
We have done a tremendous amount, particularly in the thoroughbred space. We are really the champions of horse welfare. And it has not gotten enough attention. There's still more to go. And look, I'm happy to be involved with it. It's been incredibly rewarding so far, and I feel very confident that we're going to get some of this over the line.
Pat Cummings, as always, I appreciate the insight and the advocacy and the hard work and the commitment. We will see you. We'll see you here, right? For
yes, I'll be up. I'll be up next week with Roundtable, Whitney, Sales, all that.
Yep.
Looking forward to it. I'll catch up with you then. And of course, I do have to just mention, my thanks, eternally, for Mike Rapoli putting his effort behind this. He really he cares tremendously, and is just at the point where he wants this fixed. And so Mike's efforts in this space are outstanding, and I'm so appreciative of him bringing me on to focus on it.
Very nice. Pat Cummings, everybody.
Thanks, Steve. Be well.
Thanks, Pat. Soon. There it is. Speaking of the Jockey Club Roundtable, Jim Gagliano will join us at 11:30. We've got